I'm here with the 2018 Appalachian Heritage Writer in Residence, Karen Spears Zacharias. She's the author of Weatherford Award winner and this year's One Book, One West Virginia Statewide Common Reading Selection, Mother of Rain. Karen, welcome inside Appalachia.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be here.
So first, what I'd like to ask you to do is just to read a little bit, a little passage from that novel, Mother of Rain.
I got my first lesson in mountain ways on the banks of the Holstein that day, as Whedon taught me to stay away from the dark drop-offs in the river, where the currents run fast and where snakes might hide. She showed me silvery Popeye shiners and how to use a jar as a looking glass to find mussels neath the riverbed. Whedon taught me the names of different mussels: monkey face, purple bean, rabbit's foot, and comb shells, and how their names came from the shape and color of the shells. The monkey face was brown with streaks and bumps that looked like the ears and eyes of a monkey. The purple bean shell was smooth and dark and purple on the inside. Whedon said when the Spanish came to Tennessee, the Indians gave the Spanish a string of pearls that was three times as long as Doc was tall. She read that somewhere. She had also read somewhere that mussels keep the river clear by breathing in the dirt and sand and cleaning it before spitting it out again. Mussels coat the grains of sand with some kind of slimy spit. The spit thickens and hardens, and that's what makes the sand into a pearl. It takes years for one itsy pearl to take shape, and Whedon had nearly a dozen of them. She said her mama's people fry up the slimy innards of the mussels like okra and eat them. By noon, we had 25 mussels in our pail, some as big as my palm. We teamed up and carried the bucket back to Aunt Leela's. "Mercy sakes, you two are a sight," Aunt Leela said when we come around the bend with our haul. She probably smelt us before she seen us. Mud caked our feet and arms. We were giggling and carrying on. Aunt Leela was cleaning the cobwebs off the windows with a broom. "Don't go in the house with them stinky clothes on. Strip 'em off by the back door, and I'll get you both a clean change." Aunt Leela stopped to shake the webs off the broom. "We ain't ready to clean up yet, ma'am," I said. "We're going to check these shells for pearls." Whedon and I sat there in the grass for the next hour, cracking open the mussels, admiring the insides of their houses, and searching for pearls. We each found one. Mine was as big as my thumbnail. It was whitish pink, round on the bottom, and almost pointy at the top. "It looks like a big tear," I said. "Ma's people believe pearls are creator's tears," Whedon said. "What do they say he's crying over?" "Us," Whedon said, her dark eyebrows raised, her blue-green eyes aflame. "Creator cries for us, and for what we've done to ourselves."
Wow, that is such a beautiful passage. And just for our listeners, this is the perspective from Maisie when she was a little girl still. And of course, in your novel, Mother of Rain, it follows Maisie and a number of other characters and goes back and forth from perspectives. And this, if I remember, this is kind of still an innocent time for Maisie. Tell me a little bit about why you chose this passage in your novel.
Because I think that part of what shapes us is the landscape. And certainly for me, that was true. The landscape, the Holstein River was something I was very familiar with. Had been across it many, many times and played in it as a young child. And so I think it's a landscape. It's really earth and all its beauty and glory that unites us as people. It doesn't matter if you're in China or the Sudan, or if you are in a small rural town in East Tennessee, you know what that feels like to soak your feet into the mud as a young child and to just know the sheer joy of hanging out on a riverbank.
Does the idea of landscape, does that really resonate as making someone Appalachian, sort of like a key factor of the landscape, the mountains, for you?
I think that certainly the landscape is part of it. I was a military child, and we traveled quite a bit away from my parents' home, away from kinfolk. And so I was exposed to many different landscapes, but home to me has always been going across the Holstein River and up through those hills. And just thinking back on those times as a child that I spent there with people that I loved so much and who loved me so much. So one of the things I miss most as an adult, because I've lived in Oregon longer than I lived in Tennessee or even in Georgia, I miss that landscape so much of the time. I can go back there even yet and go to my Aunt Seal's place, and the barn that we played in as children still stands. They still have livestock in it. And I can remember standing barefoot on those rails and watching the hogs feed as my Aunt Seal threw out the slop. All time washes away in those moments.
So Karen, you mentioned that you grew up in a military family, and I understand your father was killed in the Vietnam War when you were a little girl. How did that experience shape your writing and your career as both an author and a journalist? How did that shape who you have become today?
Well, I was 9 when Dad was killed in the Vietnam War, which was 1966. So that was really early on into that conflict. And prior to my dad's death, everything in our life revolved around my dad. Where we would live, what schools we would go to, where our next deployment would be. Everything was centered around my father. And when my father died, there fell this great silence over the household, where each of us in our own grief, my brother who was 12, my sister who was 7, and my mom who was 30, we each retreated to our own corners. And so the man who had been the center of our life for all those previous years, now we didn't even speak his name. Once he was buried, we didn't tell stories about him. There was nothing ever spoken. I think it wasn't until I was grown and began writing, and by that time I was in my late 40s, that we ever spoke my father's name again. The only person in my life when I was growing up that would tell me stories about my dad was his mother. And I think it's because she shared that ongoing grief. And speaking the name of her child, which was my dad, or telling stories about my dad, kept him alive for her, and certainly did for me.
Why didn't you all talk about him?
Well, I think, you know, certainly this was a different generation, different time period, and people did not talk about unpleasant things. I lived in the South. It was not okay to talk about the unpleasant things of life. And certainly the South was going through its own growing pains during the 60s and early 70s and having to confront some of its own history in those areas. But it wasn't just our family. This was a culture-wide situation. You have to keep in mind that Vietnam, that particular war, was the first one that was ever televised. It was the first one where a child could lose a parent in war and then get a TV dinner and sit down in front of the TV at night and see bodies being carried off the battlefield. that was a huge impact, and we were living in the midst of that. But in my schools, there was no mention of the war. There was never any discussions in any class that I ever had about the conflict and the war that was going on, and whether it was important or not, or whether it was moral or not. There was never any of that because we did not talk about unpleasant things.
So how did writing allow you to process through all of that?
The things a child doesn't speak about are usually the things that they feel guilty about or ashamed of. So for me, throughout my childhood and into my early adulthood, I would meet people who would ask, you know, about my family, and I would mention that my father had been killed in Vietnam. And more often than not, the typical reply was, "What a waste." Well, if you tell a child that their parents' life or their parents' death was a waste, that child will assume that guilt and assume that shame. And when I turned 30, I was a mother by that point. I was also very aware of that this is the age my mother was when her world fell apart. And I began to write about that, about what that felt like to witness that as a child. And writing gave me an order to all that chaos. I could have control over something that had controlled me for so long.
Of course, I understand that, you know, religion and faith, they play a major role in your novel, Mother of Rain. And also it plays a big part in your life. Do you think that there's a strong connection between religion and what makes someone Appalachian, whether that's through worship of like the Christian God or a great spirit or creator, as your character Bertie Luttrell mentions several times in your novel?
So for me, during that really chaotic time of my life, the church became the safe place. School was not a safe place because I happened to attend high school during the years of federal busing and the chaos of the civil rights movement. Home was not a safe place. My mother's life spiraled out of control. So what happened with me is that it was the church that provided that place of community, which is really the story of Mother of Rain. It is about how community can be that place of healing. So the church in Appalachia has been a place of community. And in that community, people who are hurting have been able to find hope. And as our culture, both in Appalachia and nationwide, has changed, the church is no longer often that place of hope or that place of healing. And so people have turned to things like opioids, because hurting people will always seek solace. It's a matter of who's going to be there to offer it to them.
So the last question I want to ask you, keeping the Appalachian language and culture alive is something that is very important to you, and you see that in your novels, and especially in at the beginning of Mother of Rain, you have a note even to the reader where you talk about you hope that your book will help to restore the Appalachian voice or the language before it's lost to future generations. And you even provide a glossary at the end that kind of looks at Appalachian style words. And I want to talk with you just as our last thought to just talk about why that's something that has been so important to you and why you're passionate about carrying on that tradition, that language, and that culture.
So that came about when I encountered Dr. Michael Montgomery at Literary Festival in South Carolina, and he was doing a presentation on the Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English. At that time, I'd been far removed from my Appalachian community and actually even the military community. And as Dr. Michael Montgomery began to speak, it brought up within me all of these voices that I had remembered from childhood. And I felt a calling back to that time and place and the people in my life who had brought healing to me and had given me a sense of home and a sense of belonging. And when I came back to Oregon, I brought back with me that Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English. And as I read through that dictionary, I thought about the fact that my own children had no idea of these words. They didn't know them. And so I wanted to write the book in the language of my childhood for my children primarily, but for the wider community at large, because the onset of television really had taken that language away. And to me, it seemed really important to capture the language of my grandmother and of my great aunt, so that when my children sat down to read the book, they would know a side of my life that they had never known. And that they would know their people, even though they weren't raised by my family in East Tennessee, they were still their people. And I wanted to give them that gift. And I wanted to archive that language in an everyday conversation. Dr. Montgomery had already done that through the dictionary, but I wanted to do it in a way that my children would see how people spoke to each other.
Karen Spears Zacharias, thank you for joining us inside Appalachia.
Thank you, Liz. I am so humbled by this honor.